Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Kotaku Split Screen, the only video game podcast that rode its horse all the way from one side of the map to the other. It's October 25th, 2018, and that means just one thing. It's time to talk about Redemption. Not just any Redemption, but Red Dead Redemption 2, Rockstar Games' incredible new open-world opus. I've finished the game, and after 70 hours have a million thoughts on it. While I was playing, Jason was reporting, publishing a feature earlier this week about work conditions that produced the game, and Rockstar Games' long-standing culture of crunch. We spend this entire episode talking about both of those things, and the many interesting ways that they intersect. There is oh so much to say, so we hope you stick around. Let's go. Welcome back to the show. It is a very exciting week in video games, and there is so much to talk about. My name is Kirk Hamilton. I am the editor-at-large at Kotaku.com, and I am joined, as ever, by the Butch Cassidy to my Sundance Kid, Mr. Jason Schreier, news editor at Kotaku. Hello, Jason.
Yeehaw!
That was good. That was good. Yeehaw! I believed it. I believed
Thank
for a minute
you.
That I was on the frontier.
It's Can you tell that I'm ready? I'm ready for some cowboy action.
Yes, you're in the Wild West. The Wild West spirit. Why might you be in the Wild West spirit, Jason?
Because, of course, Red Dead Redemption 2 comes out this week, and you have been playing it for roughly 70 hours, I believe you said?
That is correct. For roughly my entire life, I have been playing Red Dead Redemption 2 for the past week.
And that's an impressive amount of time. And there's lots to talk about. Today we're going to talk about the game. We're going to talk about what went into making the game. We're going to talk about lots of different things, the story, the gameplay, everything that you could possibly want to know about Red Dead Redemption 2. But first of all, I'm going to ask you the question that I bet all of our listeners want to know right now. How do the horse balls work? I mean, how good is that? How good is Red Dead Redemption 2?
It's very good. It's a very, very impressive game that I found. I found excellent, really, in a ton of different ways. The horse balls do appear to shrink, as far as I could tell, based on the weather. So those are my two extremely brief answers for you. I guess the horse balls thing pretty much closes the door on that question. Mm. But the quality and nature and experience of playing this game is far, far more complicated, and my feelings on it are far more complicated than could just be summed up by it's good. I mean, but yes, it is a pretty amazing video game.
Okay, that's a good summary. So if that's all you want to know, you can just stop listening there. But we're going to get into some things. Obviously, we will not be sharing any spoilers, in part because if you share spoilers, Kirk, I will just get really mad at you. So
I would not dream of it. There will be no story spoilers. I won't talk about anything past maybe like the first couple acts, which is all pretty straightforward stuff.
So lots to talk about. I want to start by something. So first of all, I should say that your review is going up at the same time as this podcast is going up. That's when the review embargo lifts. And so one of the things that I found most interesting while reading your review is that the way you describe actually playing the game and the little details that you have to go through, like you said that you have to go and take a bath and then scrub your individual body parts, it actually sounds like a lot of the moment-to-moment gameplay isn't very fun. So I'm curious, can you elaborate on that part of the game?
Yeah, I think that fun is a really complicated word. I get into this some in the review, and I tend to associate fun with sort of kinesthetic pleasure, the feeling of that not all video games have, and is actually not something I think is a prerequisite for a game to be considered a success. And, you know, it's sort of like jumping on a Goomba in Mario or firing a headshot with a hand cannon in Destiny. It's the kind of stuff that just feels really good and is just fun on its own, and you kind of get that out of it. That's not really what Red Dead Redemption is. And to put it in context, that's not really what most Rockstar games have been in my experience. I don't really find Grand Theft Auto V or even the first Red Dead Redemption to be like fun, kinesthetically pleasurable games to play. And it's because
you don't find the driving in GTA to be fun?
That's okay, driving can be very fun. That's probably the closest that game comes to kinesthetic joy. And that's always kind of been true. Like, they've gotten better at the on-foot stuff, but it used to be, you know, in Grand Theft Auto 3, the on-foot stuff was just heinous. And now at least it's kind of better. But, you know, I think that that's sort of not really what Rockstar goes for with their games, and that's not at the heart of what makes Red Dead Redemption 2 so overwhelming and remarkable and really cool. It's not that funness. So, for starters, to that example, the bathing example, you know, you don't have to go take baths. It isn't like this stuff is all mandated, though there is a lot of sort of manual things that you have to do and kind of one-off interesting sequences where, you know, you have to watch long animations for things. So the game does move very slow and very deliberately, but there's still also a lot of riding around on horseback and getting in exciting gunfights and, you know, that kind of thing. It's just that the actual physical game feel of the game isn't the thing that's so compelling. What is so compelling about it is this world that they've created. And one of the reasons that the world is so compelling is that the ways that you interact with it are so kind of like thick with detail and animation and so carefully considered. This is one of the slowest video games I've played in a very, very long time, in an outrageous way almost. It feels defiantly slow. Like, the people making it just said, fuck all of this. We're going to make you ride your horse all the way across the state and then get to this place. And when you get there, you're going to have to peruse a catalog to find the gun you want to buy. And each catalog page will have all of this information on it. And, you know, there's just this kind of level of, you know, the world, the real world, the details of the real world require you to interact with a whole lot of things in order to...
Does it feel like it's wasting your time?
No, and that's because of what I'm kind of getting at here, which is that that's part of the experience, is this slowness, is this sort of, you know, this constant sense that the world is just so big and so rich and there's so much going on. And that, I think, is integral to the experience of playing it. There's this thing that happens with Rockstar games, and I talk about all of this in my review, probably more articulately than I will on this podcast because I'm so tired, but there's a thing that happens in Rockstar games where you never quite know what's happening or what's going to happen. There's a kind of an unpredictability to everything. And it's partly because the game keeps you at arm's length. It doesn't explain everything that's happening at all times. You don't fully know why that guy's mad at you or why that thing just happened. It's very easy to accidentally do the wrong thing and set off a wild chain reaction, you know, that leads to an incredible story that you tell, but also can be frustrating and get you killed in at a time where you didn't want to die. And because of that kind of fundamental unknowability, your imagination fills in the blanks a lot of the time. You're sort of thinking, why did this happen, you know? And then you think, well, maybe there's a whole system for that, some hidden system that makes this character not like me because I came into town dirty 5 hours ago and he
saw
me.
Are you talking about story stuff or like mechanical things?
No, like more just the way the world works, not story stuff. We can maybe get into that in a second.
So can you give me an example so I can wrap my head around this?
Yeah, like you're walking into town and some guy starts yelling at you and you don't know why, and you try to diffuse it with him and he attacks you, and then your guy, you kill him, and you know, that's a really basic example of something that happens in all these games. There are times in Red Dead Redemption 2 where that kind of thing will happen, and I'll think, why did that happen? Is there more going on here than I understand? Because the game didn't lay out for me, you know, your current status with this faction of person is at 5, and if you're at 6, they will attack you. This game hides all of that from you. And so you don't know. And there are just constantly there's this feeling of sort of mystery to it. And as a result, your imagination fills in the gaps and makes the world feel more alive than it probably is. And then that's backed up by the absurd level of detail in the game, the visual and just sort of simulated detail that's happening.
Interesting.
And that makes you just think, well, they put individual package markers on my cigarette package that I'm picking up. You know, if each individual plant that I pull out of the ground has a different root attached to it that I then pull off and put in my pocket, who knows what else is in this game? And it's kind of, it leads an imagination space, I think, that makes the game very engrossing. And it's important that it, you know, waste your time, quote unquote, that it moves so slowly and really grind your nose in the experience of playing it in order to make you kind of appreciate that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Each individual root of plant has its own design.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is just, I could just start listing details. I'd list a lot of details in my
review. Yeah, give me a couple. I want to hear a couple of details.
One is that, yeah, every time you pick a plant, there are all kinds of plants you can just go pick. You pull it out of the ground, and it comes out of the ground in a complete plant that your character, Arthur Morgan, holds, and sort of, it looks like a carrot or a, I don't know, a turnip or whatever, a ginseng plant or whatever you've pulled. It is a full plant, and he kind of, you know, peels off the carrot and puts it in his pocket. It isn't some, you know, pre-baked, just, okay, plant picked animation like you would see in so many games. It's this entire elaborate thing that's unique for every plant. Another example is when you kill an animal in this game, you do a complete skinning animation and watch Arthur, you know, he cuts down the gut and pulls the skin back, and he walks around. When it's a big animal, he lifts the legs and sort of pulls the skin all the way off of it. I once was hunting.
That was in Red Dead 1 too, but it was skippable.
No, it wasn't shown in Red Dead 1. It was, you saw it from the point of view of the and it was kind of played for laughs even, which is something we can get into later. This game very rarely plays things for laughs. This is an extremely low-key and grounded game in a way that I found really striking.
Yeah, but it's very not Rockstar.
It's very not Rockstar. I mean, through and through, it is a very Rockstar game in some ways and a very not Rockstar games in others. But yeah, so you the skinning thing, I don't know, everything with the animals. I was just hunting this morning when I was playing around the open world, and I kind of shot a deer badly. Like, I just hit it a couple times in the torso and it went down, and I come to its body and it's still alive, and it was kind of crying out like an animal would if you had shot it, and I had to shoot it and then skin it, and the skin was messed up because I'd shot it badly. There's just so much stuff like that in this game that you're kind of constantly discovering, and it leads to this incredible experience of playing it. I mean, it is just so evident that so much work was put into every tiny, tiny little corner. And that winds up actually having an effect beyond just a box-checking thing or something that's very impressive and makes for shareable moments. It makes the game itself feel unlike really any other video game.
It's funny because, and this makes for a good segue to the story that we published this week, but while I was talking to people who worked at Rockstar, a lot of them were like, this is unlike any, like, we're trying to make something totally new, we're trying to make something unlike any other video game, and I think some people were skeptical when they saw that, but it sounds like that really is the case.
It is, and you know, and I should talk about the story some, because this game has a really involved and really
amazing story. Yeah, I was going to say, before we talk about my article, I was going to ask you, so one of the things that you and I were skeptical about with Red Dead 2 back when we were talking about this on the show and seeing all the trailers, the first few trailers and whatnot, is Arthur Morgan, because he seems from all the trailers to be this total boring, dullard, like typical, just gruff protagonist criminal. And I was just like, ugh, after the interesting, fascinating, fantastic, I would say, three protagonists of GTA 5, we were hoping for something a little bit different. Has your opinion of Arthur Morgan changed after actually playing the game? What's the story like? What's the gist of it?
Yeah, so yes, to answer that question, yes, my opinion of Arthur has changed significantly. I think he's a fantastic character. I was wrong to doubt that he would be a great character. He's amazing.
That's really good to hear.
No spoilers, but his journey and his story is amazing. Richard Clark, the actor who plays him, is incredible. The animation and motion capture and all the work done to bring him to life throughout the game and in cutscenes is really something else. And yeah, I mean, he starts out very much as this sort of Marlboro man. I think I describe him as Chris Pine cosplaying as the Marlboro man. He's very, very handsome in a kind of generic way. He's just another big white guy that you're playing as in a video game. He feels a little like a tabula rasa. And then as time goes on, the game peels away layer after layer of his sort of grizzled exterior. And you learn about him. And he keeps a journal and you read his journal is fabulously well done. It was written, I think, by Laszlo and Dan Houser, the two writers, and it's
is incredibly cool. I mean, it's like handwritten, and I recommend people read, keep up with the journal, and you read the actual writing, and not because you can press a button to just read the print, you know, the easier to read font text, but read what he's writing, because he crosses things out and he spells things wrong, and you get an insight into who he is. One interesting thing in this game is that, like in the first one, you can play on a sliding scale of sort of villainous or heroic, and if you do that, there are these small changes in the story, and one of the changes is actually Arthur's journal changes somewhat. So I should say that my journal is based on a very, very virtuous playthrough. I played him as good uh-huh. a guy, basically, as I could. I mean, he's still a scoundrel and a villain, and he's a criminal, but played him as a virtuous scoundrel. And so the journal is really amazing, and he just is a great character. I mean, really great. It's the kind of thing that I could see people will start playing this game and think, oh, I don't really like this guy. He's kind of, I don't know, he's kind of overly gruff. I don't relate to him. Play the whole game. get to the end, because he is remarkable. So the story overall also is, I think, really something else. I think it's a, you know, whatever buzzwordy landmark achievement in game narrative like terms you want to use that I tried to avoid using in my review that I'm now tired enough to probably lapse into on this podcast. I do think that it is a real achievement in narrative.
Tour de force.
It's a whatever. Yeah, sure.
And the first Red Dead certainly was.
Right.
So it's not a surprise.
Which is fascinating, really, because, yeah, it, of course, the first Red Dead Redemption is one of the great stories. I think I hyped this last week, but Tim Rogers, our colleague, made this video recapping the entire plot of Red Dead Redemption 1, which I actually watched. I've played that game several times. You and I streamed it recently, but watching his video is very helpful. It's also just entertaining. He does the whole thing in, like, you know, early 20th century vernacular, and it's a really fun watch. But it is incredible how thoroughly the sequel, which is a prequel, actually, it takes place 10 years before Red Dead Redemption 1, but it is a sequel, how thoroughly this game ties in with the original and complements it and treats it as something that you have played. It assumes you have played it, and you're meeting all these people that you mostly hunted down and killed in the first game. You uh-huh. know this all ends in ruin, and that this, you know, this whole thing is going to fall apart. And that's a big part of the theme of this game, is just about, like, entropy and despair and lies and the death of a lie. I mean, it's a very big bummer of a story, and that makes it so interesting to me and so cool. It's just, this video game is nothing like most games that are so, you know, they want to entertain you, they want to thrill you, they want to make you feel powerful. This game disempowers you at so many turns, inconveniences you at so many turns, it forces you to just struggle through it. It's difficult to play. The story is hardcore. I mean, horrible things happen to people that you like. It really just is a hard-hitting, grim game with a point to make.
It reminds me, I mean, the way you talk about it reminds me of The Last of Us and the way
so,
that we were
yes,
talking about The
and
Last
it,
of Us.
It certainly will bring about comparisons to that game because, and I said that I believe in my review of The Last of Us, I made the same point about fun. I said I don't think I would call this game fun in the way that video games are traditionally fun, but it is so many other descriptors, and I feel mm-hmm. that way about this too. I think The Last of Us is a good comparison. Far Cry 2 is actually a good comparison because of that game's very bleak look at life and sort of its embrace of entropy as a sort of central narrative theme, which is super what this game is about. I mean,
yeah.
We know that this gang falls apart and that everything goes to shit. That's not a spoiler because that was in the first game. And so you realize that you're going to watch this happen, but it is incredibly, incredibly well done.
So, okay. So let's talk about the other half of this equation.
Yeah.
So a bit of background here. For ages now, there have been rumblings that at Rockstar, there is this culture of crunch. And what crunch means is overtime, putting in nights and weekends at the office, putting in all these extra hours in your work. Oftentimes it's unpaid, usually it's unpaid, and it is a very common epidemic in the video game industry. It is something that happens not just for weeks at a time, but potentially for months at a time. It could be on and off. It could be, hey, we're going to crunch three nights a week. Hey, we're going to crunch Saturdays for like every other Saturday. It could be in all sorts of forms, but it is huge. There are a few studios that are whispered about in the video game industry as being the crunchiest studios. Naughty Dog is one of them. CD Projekt Red is another one of them. And Rockstar has always been one of them. Not coincidentally, or maybe coincidentally, I don't know, three studios known for making some of the greatest games out there.
Right.
So I had for a while now wanted to do a story about Rockstar and examining whether things have changed since the days of Red Dead Redemption 1, when a bunch of anonymous spouses of Rockstar employees put together a letter and said, hey, we don't see our husbands or wives because they're working for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and just detailing all the horrible conditions there. And I had been hearing that things were still pretty bad for some people over there. But a lot of people have been telling me that, like, let me wait until Red Dead 2 shows. I'm probably going to leave. I want to get my bonus. I want to wait until after the game comes out, then talk about it. That was the basic sentiment that I've been hearing. Mm-hmm. Then came 2 weeks ago. So New York Magazine published an article in which, or it was even last week. My God, it's time is compressed so much.
Yeah, I mean,
we
talked about that article last week. I mean, we briefly, you know, discussed it. That had happened.
The article in New York Magazine, it was a puff piece. It was this fluffy preview thing that talked about the making of Red Dead 2, had a couple of interesting details, had an interview with Dan Houser, who is the co-founder of Rockstar and the lead writer on this game.
Yeah, one of three
He and his
writers,
brother run the company.
He's credited as one of three writers on the game.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I mean, he seems to be the creative, you know.
The lead writer, yeah. Writer, so yeah. The two Houser brothers, they run the company, essentially. So Dan Houser said in this article, there was a little quote of him saying, we were working 100-hour weeks to finish the game. That caused a blow-up. It led to no end of controversy, in part because the New York Magazine article hadn't explained it or went into it or probed it or followed up on it and just like presented it as a detail alongside like the script has 500,000 words.
Yeah,
we worked 100-hour weeks. So that happened. Long story short, it led to a whole lot of controversy. Rockstar employees were given permission to speak out on social media. And basically Rockstar did a lot of things that were trying to counteract what they knew would be articles about what was happening. And so I published this article on Tuesday of this week. I had actually not expected to hear from as many people as I did, but at the end of the day, I wound up hearing from close to 80 current and former employees, like a mix. So 30 something current employees, 40 something former employees, plus another 12 that Rockstar provided for me in this bizarre experience in New York, which I'll talk about in a second.
Hear more about that in a minute.
But the employees short version is, and you can read the 10,000 word article to
the Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Get the full picture of this, but short version is, for a lot of people have very positive experiences at Rockstar, but for a lot of people there's this culture of crunch and a culture where you only succeed at the company if you put in those extra hours. Even if they're not necessarily mandatory, you still feel like you have to do them. And for some people, depending on their team and their lead and their manager and their office, Rockstar has 8 different offices across the world, in Scotland and the UK and Boston and San Diego and New York. So depending on your circumstances, you might have totally different experiences. Some people said, hey, I work 50, 45 hours a week, normal schedule, and that's totally fine. Other people said, yeah, my boss has told me that I have to work more hours. Like, we're told we have to come in on Saturdays. The studio that has it worst is Rockstar Lincoln in the UK, which is their QA department. They talk the most about their brutal conditions. But also Rockstar New York, I heard a lot of really bad stories from there. There's a tons of other details that I won't get into. One salient one is that a lot of people said they're told to come in on weekends just in case the Housers are there, so they can see them.
That one stuck out to me too. That one was a lot.
Yeah, the overall picture that I heard is that people felt like it was more important to work hours than long hours than it was to do work, and like that was the culture of the studio. That's not the case for every part of the studio, but it's the case for a lot of people who spoke to me. Something that stood out to me was how many of those people said they reached out because of Hauser's comments, and not just because of the 100-hour weeks thing, which they thought was kind of just him exaggerating, but his clarification comments afterwards, in which he said that when he said 100-hour weeks, he was referring to only the writing staff, only for a short period of time, and that nobody's forced to work. I think he said, work hard at this company.
Yeah.
A lot of people took issue with that and were like, hey, like, I am okay working a lot of hours. I knew what I was getting into when I started working here. But for Hauser to just completely discount what I was saying is totally fucked up. And so that was a sentiment I heard a lot. Let me tell you about the New York thing, because that was pretty bizarre. So Rockstar traditionally has been a secretive company. They have been a company that just does not talk to the press a lot. And usually they'll no comment you if you ask them about something. For this, I was surprised to hear they wanted me to come in and talk to employees because they wanted their employees to tell me how good things were. And this was very similar to when they gave employees permission to talk on social media, and a lot of them shared positive experiences. So they had me come into their office. I expected when I came in to be talking to some like top level people, maybe do some video conferences with people at different studios. I wasn't exactly sure what was going to happen because they didn't give me a list of who I was going to talk to or anything like that. What happened was they put me in a room with Simon Ramsey, Rockstar's head PR guy. And so he and I were sitting there, and there were some technical issues getting the life-size video conferencing working, because that happens at every company in the world.
That's funny.
Rockstar, they're just like us. And eventually we got on, and the first one was two studios at once. So there was a box in one side of the screen with three employees at Rockstar North. And then there was a box on the other side of the screen with two employees at Rockstar New England.
This is like the Brady Bunch credits that you're like
exactly.
talking to.
And then Simon, the PR, Rockstar said a PR, was like, all right, go ahead, ask whatever you want. And it was the most bizarre thing. I've never before had an interview of five people at once, PR guy next to me, and me expected to be asking them about crunch and workplace conditions. I was like, man, all right, I'm just going to do this. And I just did this. And it was a total of 12 people at the end of the day that I interviewed. And they all told me about their various experiences. And I certainly believe that they were telling the truth when they said things like, yeah, I mean, things were bad, but they've gotten better. This is the easiest crunch that we've had, et cetera, et cetera. But like, there are parts of your story you're going to leave out when you're in a group chat and the head of PR sitting next to you. And right. It was just very bizarre. It was very rock star in that, like, I feel like they thought that I was just going to like accept this, I guess, and they didn't realize why I might be skeptical of conditions like that. It was just very strange. And yeah, so read the whole article if you want to know the full picture. One thing that I'll share that I haven't shared publicly yet, kind of a little split screen scoop for people, is that since the article went live, I've heard from a lot of current former Rockstar employees, a lot of current, especially Rockstar employees, variety of things. I won't share them all, but one thing that really resonated with me was hearing from someone who messaged me and just said, like, thank you. I just got so emotional reading this because it made me realize that I'm not alone feeling this way. I think something that's really salient here is that a lot of Rockstar employees see themselves as a family. The less charitable way of looking at this is that they see themselves as a cult, or that they are a cult. part of that, I think, is just buying into this rock star culture and being like, hey, we make some of the best games in the world. We put in the hours because we're passionate about this. We really care about this. And that's how we are able to make games like Red Dead 2 with so much detail and just like game-changing equations. And GTA 5, like the most profitable game ever. That's how we're able to do this because we're this tight-knit family. And I think that it's not bad people. Like, these are not bad people who believe this. I think that's just part of what it's like to work there. And I think they don't even realize how awful it can be for other people who don't buy into it and how uncomfortable they can make people and like how some people who just want to work their hours and then leave just can't work there. And that's very much oversimplifying. There are a lot of other factors and a lot of things that are way worse than that kind of generous way of looking at things. But it really resonated with me that person was like, wow, like other people really feel this way. Now I finally feel like I can be talking to people about this. And it's one other person told me that like for the first time they were able to just be having conversations about this problem and seeing it as a problem. And so in that sense, I really hope that this can push for some change. And I'm getting a little optimistic that it can lead to some good things for the company, which makes me really happy because I really enjoy Rockstar's games. And that's part of like a lot of people have been, or some angry fanboys have been like, oh, this is a hit piece. And even some people at Rockstar, I got the message that like there was this sentiment that like, oh, Jason has this narrative in his mind and he just wants to bring us down. And no, of course not. I want a company that makes games that I really enjoy to be treating its workers better. So you and I have talked about the parallels between the game and the studio. And I want to get into that a little bit. So why don't we actually take a quick break, and then you and I will talk a lot more about all this stuff. We'll talk more about crunch, the ethics of crunch, the questions of whether you and I crunch to put out these two massive articles we put out this week, and much more. So let's take a break.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life one week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back for more rootin' tootin' cowboy action. Kirk, so we talked about the game. We talked about the work conditions under which this game were made. Something you really talked about a lot in your review are the parallels between the game's story and the stories that we've heard out of Rockstar. So why don't you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so some of that is my own artistic read. I do think that there are things in the sort of subtext and thematic content of this game that interestingly reflect aspects of what we've heard about how it was made. It's also, it's interesting on a kind of bigger level than that too. So I guess we can get into both of those. On the bigger level, this game is very, like I was saying earlier, is very about entropy and about the cost of progress. It's, a common theme, and definitely was a theme in the first game, is explored much more exhaustively and much more resonantly, I think, in the sequel. This idea that wherever you go, there you are, that humans destroy everything they touch. There's sort of an ongoing thing with the Dutch Vanderlinde gang where Dutch, who is a tremendous villain in this game, one of the greatest, he's more than a villain. I mean, he's just a great character, but he is just a fantastic character.
Because the way you described him reminded me of Tony Soprano.
He is like that kind of, he's that kind of character. He's wonderful. Benjamin Byron Davis is the actor who played him and did a killer job. Very well written. I mean, he's just so believable as a guy. And so he's this leader who is in so many ways such a good leader. And part of the reason for that is that he really cares about everyone. I mean, he is the patriarch of this large community, the Vanderlyn Gang, which is sort of your, you know, your big hub community that moves around the map and is kind of, you know, there's a whole, you know, upkeep homestead thing associated with them. And Arthur is a big part of this family. He's, you know, kind of a higher up lieutenant in this gang. And they do all kinds of crime, but they also really care for one another. And they're very varied. And some of them are very sympathetic. And so it's very complicated. And the way the gang is realized is really cool. And then Dutch is at the head of all of that. So Dutch is so believable in part because he's the kind of leader that we've seen before. He's a very dangerous kind of person. And what he's doing is in some ways reflective of the ways that people can sort of lead their employees to do self-harming things and to work against their own interests or against their own interests. Like, he is, you know, his belief in this game is we are going to get there. We are going to get to this unblemished paradise, this perfect homestead, this free land that we can call our own and just finally be free of all of this. If we just get one more score and a little bit more money. And that is the returning theme of this game. And then, of course, in the efforts to get more money, everything goes to shit. The feds show up, the whoever shows up, something horrible happens. Over and over again, this happens. And it's this running theme that these people destroy everywhere they go. They are poison. And more broadly, civilization and humanity is poison. It is destroying the world. I mean, a big part of this game that resonated with me was this sort of environmental subtext that I picked up they didn't rub your face in it, but it's something that I got quite a bit out of this game, in part because it's just so visually beautiful and its recreation of nature is so moving. But just the fact that it is about how progress is destroying the world and how this beautiful natural world that we live in is crumbling, and yet this video game is itself the product of the culture that it is indicting. You know, it is all of the technological progress, all of the inventions, all of the things that have allowed for a workforce this large to create something this incredible are also the things that are sort of destroying the world. And so that's the big level, you know, the big level self-critique that this game has. And it lives in this kind of interesting paradoxical place that I think a lot of great art, especially art created right now, lives in, because it's created, it could never have been created without the culture that it usually is critiquing.
What's interesting about this is that, like, we can all recognize some of ourselves in it, but that's another segue. So say what you're going to say, and then
Well, so there's also this sort of lower level thing, which is that the game and the characters in it reflect the process of creating it. I mean, this has been so fantastic reviewing the game and talking with you about your reporting and reading your article as I reckon with this huge, very chewy, complicated game has been a wonderful and enlightening critical experience, because I know so much about how it was made. I've heard so many stories on both sides about the pride and the hard work, and then also the sort of horrible overwork and the crunch and all of the labor and expense that was required to create something that obviously looks labor intensive and expensive, but to know the specifics is very helpful. And so I could view this game through that lens because I knew all that, which was really great. There are so many times in this game where you're looking at a crisis. It's a game about a group having a crisis of leadership where the leaders are not working in the same interest as the people under them. There are so many lines. There's a line, I'm going to quote it here. I quoted this in my review, where Dutch says to people, and you know, who are kind of grousing about not really believing in him anymore, because of course that sort of starts to happen. He says, "This isn't a prison camp. I am not forcing anybody to stay. So either we're in this together, working together to get out together, or we're not. There simply isn't a reality in which we do nothing and get everything." And over and over again, there are these quotes that could well have been said by a team lead at some major video game studio crunching on a video game.
That's funny.
It's remarkable. And I think this is a thing that I've seen before. I'm not the first person to point this out.
I mean, I talked about this in my book with Uncharted 4 and how Uncharted 4 is a story about, like, this guy who's addicted to the thrill. Of like his it's about him trying to balance his passion and his life and how it almost destroys his relationship,
which is super true, and how that was, you know, something that the people making that game certainly felt. I think Lee Alexander pointing this out kind of was one of the first things I read that really opened my eyes to this idea that BioShock, and when she wrote about BioShock Infinite and how this is a game about sort of a leader who created a fractured society that worked against itself across purposes. And she put it better than I could summarize it, but it really resonated with me reading that. I was like, holy shit, that's so true. And everything we've heard of the development of that game indicates that Columbia was in some ways a reflection of Irrational Games. And there are other games that do that too. And I really, like, from beginning to end, was very struck both by how this game, like, critiqued and echoed its own development, and also critiqued and echoed the worldwide culture and just the world that allows something this spectacular to exist. I thought those were really just striking aspects of it.
So I was talking to somebody who works at Rockstar, and they actually had one of the most interesting conversations I had with this person who was like, this is art. I'm doing 70-hour weeks. I've been doing this for a long time. I'm fine with that. This is what I accept. And one, like, they were defending Crunch basically to me. And mm-hmm. I had a long conversation with them because I was like, how is this sustainable? And they were like, it's probably not. And I don't know how much longer I can do this. But they also said, if we were not putting in these hours, if I was not working this hard, the game might take another 2 years to make, if it were ever released at all, or maybe we would cut it down. And I think a lot of times when you ask a developer, hey, how can you reduce crunch? How can you end crunch? The answer is always some combination of, like, better scheduling, reducing scope, being willing to cut down superfluous details, being willing to just lose stuff if you can't make it in on time. If you can't extend your target release date, then you have to just cut stuff so you can make it on time. Is it possible to make a game like Red Dead Redemption 2 with as much, with the scope and scale it has, a game that was made in 8 years, a game that's the product of tons of iteration and scrapping and overhauling and just finding the fun, that whole process. Is it possible to do that without the culture of overwork that Rockstar Games has? And I don't know if there's an easy answer to that. I think some people would argue, yes, absolutely, it's possible to do that. It's totally possible to make good art without sacrifice and so on and so on. But other people would argue that you can't get the types of details of, like, picking up a plant and seeing individually designed roots in each one without having people who are willing to put in that extra time. And this is going to be a question that haunts the video game. It's a question that's haunted the video game industry for decades. It's one that will continue to haunt the video game industry. And it's one that can be debated and talked about in all sorts of nuanced ways. I'm curious to hear what you make of this. Do you believe in the theory that no great art is made without sacrifice? Do you think it's possible for a team of 300 people to work 8-hour days for a couple of years and make a game like this?
So I do think that it's possible.
Sorry, a team of 2,000 people.
Yeah, Rockstar. I was going to say, it's a lot more than that. Yes, I do think that it's possible to make art without that kind of sacrifice. I think that all art requires a lot of work. It's very difficult. Whether it's currently possible, whether it's possible at a studio like Rockstar, maybe not, but that doesn't mean that it's never going to be. Like, possible means, is it possible? So yes, I think it's absolutely possible. There are always things that are going to be cut. There were things that were cut from Red Dead Redemption 2. It's all a matter of what you're willing to do and what you're willing to sacrifice to not do that, and who's making the decisions on that. I think with different decisions, you could still totally make an incredible game. I mean, the details, while amazing and part of what make the game so appealing, there's a diminishing returns on them, certainly. I mean, there comes a point where you're just like, okay, I get it. The game is really detailed. I mean, the story is great. The world is beautiful. They could have done, I'm sure, a lot of that. And, you know, it's almost not even worth theorizing. I think there's, like, an important sort of sister discussion to this one, which is there's labor and then there's compensation. And the compensation question sort of ties in with this and ties in with some of the unionization talk we've done, which is just, well, if you want people to work more, you should pay them more. You know, you should make it more voluntary and make it more paid and kind of find a way to make that work. It seems like that fits in maybe with this somewhat, or maybe a lot, like, sort of fundamentally, to find a solution. Do you think, does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in general terms. So let's talk about Rockstar specifically. So at Rockstar, there are some people are paid hourly and some people are paid salary. I don't know the exact breakdown. I know that a lot of the testers at Lincoln are paid hourly and did get overtime pay. I know that a lot of junior level people at their various studios are paid hourly. It really depends on your department, your position, and so on. The thing is, if you're paid hourly, that means you're, I believe that they're not on the same benefits as salaried employees. I believe you would be on a temporary contract of some form. And that's what it's tied into. The other part of this equation is bonuses. And bonuses are a really big part of Rockstar. You get an annual bonus no matter what. The bonus will go up significantly on years that a game ships. So this year, a lot of people are hoping that they will receive substantial bonuses.
I think that's probably a pretty safe bet that those people are going to get substantial
bonuses.
Well,
it depends. I mean, it'll vary drastically depending where you work and which department.
Oh, yeah, I just mean if it's sales-based, this game is probably going to sell.
Yeah, well. I'm sure this game is going to do monstrous numbers sales-wise. So there are a lot of complicating factors here. And what I heard from some people is that, like, hey, if I'm paid hourly, but, like, I have to work overtime just to make as much as someone who's paid salaried, then it's just kind of like a no-win situation for me, right? Because you're just screwed either way. And I heard that from some people. I heard stories that, unfortunately, I can't share because I don't want to identify people, but I heard stories of, like, people who just could not make enough money for various reasons and just tough, a lot of struggling stories. So it's a tough question. And something that I've always said is that, like, I believe in unionization, and I believe that every studio, if it unionizes, should just be fighting for whatever it wants in its own contract, right?
Yeah, and you know, I agree with that. And there's also a sort of there's another way to look at this, or a way I'm trying to look at it, which is, it's not just about can we do this without this kind of crunch. Really, and I think this is true of a lot of really big questions that we're wrestling with, you know, climate change or whatever, political polarization, a lot of things. There's also just the question of, can we make it better? And that's a much easier question to answer, I think. Yes, of course. Of course we can make it better. Everyone can be better. Every company can do better. Kotaku can do better. Everyone can do better all the time. Anywhere you've ever worked can do better. And so that is a much more achievable goal. And it does actually seem to be something that Rockstar has been doing and is trying to do. I mean, I buy them saying it's not like it was with Red Dead 1. I think enough people said that it does seem...
Yeah,
I mean,
a lot of
Red
people
Dead,
said
granted,
that. Even the people who,
like,
said they had it really bad.
Yeah, and it sounds like Red Dead 1 was over the top egregious. And, you know, that wasn't that long ago. But they are changing. I mean, we could look at Kotaku and say, what was it like to work at Kotaku 10 years ago? It was very different than it is now.
Yes.
And it's much, much better now. So, you know, I think any major organization is going to be that way. And so that tracks. So the question of just can we make things better is a maybe more useful one to ask than is it possible to make art without sacrifice? And also, it begins to get into solutions much more quickly. And a union clearly is one of them, you know. Our union, we've talked about this before, our union didn't fix everything that we don't like about our jobs, but it certainly made them better.
And it protects things. And yeah, so the point I was going to make earlier is that I think that some studios might say, hey, some of us like putting in overtime. We want to be able to have the flexibility to spend more time at the office if we want to. So we want paid overtime, but we want that overtime to be paid. We don't want our union contract to restrict hours at all. We just want those extra hours to be paid.
Right.
Other studios might say, hey, we don't want to work any overtime. We want 9-hour days, and that's the end of it. And that's what we want in our union contract. And I think having a union, what's most important about that is that it gets the worker a seat at the table. And, like, for all of the negatives that people like to espouse about unionization and unions and the history of unions in this country and the things that they've done, I think that the one inarguable point is that right now the average worker does not have a seat at the table, does not have any sway or any decision-making capabilities at a big company, and that is a problem.
That seems like a grave imbalance. I agree.
Yeah, exactly. The people who are just doing the most work and just the people who are not paid as well as the top people just should have some input. I'm not saying that the CEO of a company shouldn't be making the decisions, but I think that, like, the CEO should be mandated to listen to a representative from the rest of the workers, at the very least have someone be able to talk to them. Because I actually do think that that's a problem at Rockstar, is that there's this inner circle of managers who are kind of insulated and don't really have the same communication communication with employees as they should. And if there was, like, as part of that inner circle, as part of that board or whatever it is, there was a union rep, that would change things a lot, I think.
Yeah, and even to what you were saying earlier about how there's, you know, there are a lot of bad stories about unions. There are downsides to unions. Historically, unions have been vilified in various ways. Unions are not exempt from the thing I was saying earlier about getting better. Unions also get better. Everyone is able to improve and do things better. I mean, unions have been around for a long time, and we are possibly entering a new kind of era of unions for, you know, kind of people who work in media and who work in technology. And those are new industries, and those industries have a chance to kind of rewrite the rules of unionization. I've learned so much about what's possible with the union by the union that we've been in that I never would have known or guessed just because I had no idea. And also because I was basing my knowledge of unions on, you know, what people had been saying for years, but that weren't based on modern circumstances. So that's also something worth keeping in mind. And that's just one solution. I mean, unionization is helpful, but there are also other things. You know, there are just cultural ways that cultures can just change and slowly get better. And I have more optimism and hope about that, I think, at Rockstar and just everywhere, just sort of broadly.
The one thing that makes me, like, pause before I say, like, all crunch can be eliminated is just hearing stories of iteration. And iteration is what that means is things changing. And it's the most important part of any game is the ability to just take something and then tweak it and refine it and just play with it and revise it over and over again. And that is such an important part of any video game's development, is like whether you're talking about just like the feeling of gunplay and like shooting aliens in Destiny and how many times that has been revised over and over again before it's actually put into the game, or something bigger scale like the way that cinematics look in Red Dead Redemption 2. Like, all of that stuff is just super important, and I think that as a result of that, there's no way for any game company to accurately say how long something might take. They can certainly make estimates, but I think there's always going to be that extra bit, that buffer that you need, and you don't know how long that buffer is going to take. You don't know how long it's going to take to find the fun, quote unquote. So I do think crunch can be alleviated. I also think that scheduling is always going to be really tough for game studios, and yeah, it needs to be made a priority from the very top, like top people saying, hey, we do not want to crunch. For example, a friend of the podcast, Kim Swift, she has just been a super anti-crunch advocate. And she always says, like, when I am talking about projects and stuff, I'm just like, from the top, we are avoiding crunch. We are scheduling things to avoid crunch. And that's easier said than done. But like, that's where the change needs to start from, at the very top of these companies.
I agree with what you were saying about that, just about iteration. And I mean, I don't know, as a writer, any album I've made, any music I've made, any writing I've done, anyone who's ever done anything like that, you get to this point where you've written the thing and you are just going over it and over it and over it and over it, and then taking 5 minutes away and then going over it and over it again. I mean, that is how a lot of things are created, because like you just need to get it that good. That is a part of the creative process, and it's difficult to schedule around that. I mean, right. I totally agree. It's just that thing of, can we make this better? Can we account for this to a greater extent? Can we make this a priority? And that is, I think, what needs to happen.
So let's talk about ourselves. Let me read an email from a listener.
Nice talk of the games industry, let's get to the real shit, ourselves.
This is from Chase. Chase says, hey guys, hey Jason, congratulations on the amazing story on Red Dead Crunch. I particularly liked your transparency. I'm curious, as a fellow journalist, I often find myself working long hours, often without overtime compensation, though I do sometimes get comp time. That is contradictory to my own opinions about work. If you work the time, you get paid. How do you balance longer work schedules? Comp time? Overtime? This Red Dead story must have had its own crunch. I hope public talks about crunch opens up the pathway for journalists and other workers to talk about our own poor work habits and conditions. This is something that I have been struggling with a lot, because every time someone would tell me, like, oh man, I just wanted to save a few extra hours to put in all this work, I just can relate a lot, because I am also a workaholic who tends to work a lot after hours. And while I think things are a little bit different for a variety of reasons that we'll get into, work-life balance is still something I struggle with. And sometimes I wonder, like, am I being such a hypocrite by reporting on these work-life balance problems at other studios while also working constantly? So Tell me what you make of this, Kirk, first, and tell me about your own schedule.
Yeah, I have a lot of the same thoughts that I think you've had. And here's my first big thought on this, and I think it helps me sort of understand where people who like to crunch are coming from. So the last week, I've been joking about how, you know, I've barely seen Emily. I've been doing nothing but working on this review. And it has been, you know, an outrageous amount of work. I've been working, 14-hour days or something. I've been marathoning this game. And then for the last several days, I've just been writing and writing and writing. I mean, I haven't written this hard maybe since my Destiny 2 review or something, where just so much writing and iteration and editing. So that has been exhausting. I mean, I'm exhausted right now. Anything I say on this podcast doesn't actually count because I'm so exhausted. Just kidding. I mean, every word of it. But I made this joke to you earlier. When I look back at the last week, I'm like, okay, but my version of crunch is playing a really amazing video game for 70 hours. And for, you know, the bulk of that was spent doing that. So that's not really crunch, is it? So, okay, that's true, right? I mean, playing video games is pretty fun. Red Dead Redemption 2 is pretty rad. So, like, it was cool to spend 70 hours playing it. However, I do think that that's a helpful way to think of the mindset of someone who's really proud of their work and who loves making, in this case, making video games, in our case, putting out articles, in your case, doing reporting that's really important. In anyone's case, the work that they're doing. When you love the work that you're doing, when you're so excited to publish, or you're so excited to finish, or you can't wait, in this case, for people to play the game that you've been working on for 8 years that you know is so amazing, that is really motivating and makes it really fun to work so hard. So we do this to ourselves. I mean, I did. I signed up for this. I said, all right, I want to do this. I want this to be like a big ass review that I'm going to bust my ass on, and I'm going to do it because it's the biggest game of the year, and damn it, I'm excited. And then voluntarily went and did that. And so, yeah, I think that that helps me understand that mindset. And that is something that people voluntarily do. And that doesn't necessarily make it not, you know, bad is kind of such a simple word. It doesn't remove the problematic aspects of it that we choose to do it. People choose to do all kinds of harmful things to themselves, and those things are still worth examining and understanding. But yep, it changes it somewhat. And it definitely is important to understand that, to also view this just as not quite as stark of a sort of, you know, guy at the top mandating everybody work so hard thing, because it is much more complicated than that. And actually viewing it that way removes a lot of the agency from the people who love doing this and who are actually doing the work and who we're kind of talking about, which is never mm-hmm. something that you want to do. So that's my first thought.
Very good points all around. Something that I think about a lot is that, first of all, journalism is just a different world. I think that you have to be willing to work at least somewhat odd hours in journalism, just because you got to be reporting, you got to be willing to respond to people immediately, you got to be just finding stories. Like if news breaks, it doesn't wait.
It kind of requires you to move at the same speed as culture, which is just a constant speed. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, like, one of the reasons that I spent the past week crunching nonstop on this story and working nonstop on this Rockstar story is because I wanted to make sure that not only were we the most thorough account of everything, but also that we were first and that we weren't beaten to the punch. And I think that's an extremely important aspect of journalism. I think something that makes our work, you and I's work, a little bit different, well, very different, is that when we publish things, our names are directly on them.
Yes.
We are the bylines, we get bylines, our work is known by people. People get to know us, people get to hear us on this show, people get to, you know, that all this work that you've put in over the past week to your Red Dead review, you know, as soon as it goes up, it's going to be read by thousands of people, and then over the course of the next day, it will be read by hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people. So that itself, I think, changes the equation a little bit. It's also a much tighter turnaround. I think crunch is very different in bursts, and I have never in my life had to crunch, work nights and weekends for longer than like a couple of weeks or like a month at most to finish Blood, Sweat, and Pixels. So I don't know what it's like to crunch for months, and I can't even imagine that. But just the immediate gratification aspect of that, the fact that your name is on it, that you get the credit, I think it must be a lot tougher if you are an animator at a studio or a designer at a studio, and you know that you're really proud of your work, but how many people are going to know it was you? And that, I think, is a logistical problem of games. It's a systemic problem of games that people just aren't recognized enough, that we don't spend enough time talking about the individual people who contribute to these games. Part of the problem is that we just don't know. Like, we don't know who made that level, who made that tree, who made the root of that plant look as good as it does. So that's something that I think is our jobs to talk about more. But that, I think, can help make the crunch feel more, I don't know, feel less painful for you and I.
I think that that's true. And that also kind of highlights a broader idea, which is that anyone who overworks or struggles with work-life balance, whatever industry they're in, is going to do it in a different way for different reasons with different incentives. And it'll require, you know, understanding in a different way. Even while I think it's also worth just keeping in mind that all of this is sort of, you know, the byproduct of a capitalist society that we're so, you know, just sort of have just been soaking in our entire lives and are so fundamentally just hard-coded to follow, at least the older among us. I feel like the younger generation and younger people that I meet are less, you know, hard-coded into it than I am. And,
yeah,
you know, all these socialists that I meet. That, and that's wonderful, I think, to hear people just say, well, wait, maybe it doesn't have to be this way, which is kind of always the job of the young. And
yeah, and part of that is equating working hard to working long hours.
True.
Which is like part of the problem. It's like, and you brought this up on the last crunch conversation we had 2 years ago, which was that, like, we have this culture of we just want to brag about, like, nobody wants to say, like, oh yeah, last week I went home every day after work at 5 p.m. People want to say, oh man, I worked this intense shift last week. Oh man, I worked so many hours. Like, that's just how people are.
And, you know, and it gets to a thing I talked about last week, this idea of shame, which I want to come back to because I do think that it's very interesting. Because when I talk about that concept, which I've heard I've heard brought up as a way to bring about cultural change in other ways, I think it's typically referring to Me Too and the way that men treat women in the workplace. But it was, you know, it's not just, when I say shame, I don't just mean, you know, publicly shaming someone like Rockstar for their bad behavior. Like, that's usually when people think of shame these days, they think of shaming someone, which is a very, you know, very public and very aggressive and very big thing. But I'm talking more about the fact that if a culture can kind of begin to agree that certain things aren't ideal, aren't good, then those things will begin to change because people will no longer think it's okay to do them and to then talk about doing them. In this case, if overwork and the whole I'm so busy thing starts to be seen as less of a thing to brag about and maybe not something to be proud of and not something that we want to reinforce, then gradually, and I mean gradually, like over the course of decades, people will do it less. And that could happen. I mean, the whole I'm so busy thing is definitely more complicated than just us wanting to brag about how busy we are. It's also a function of how the internet works and the fact that our attention is constantly being, you know, pulled in 100 directions and we always feel busy. But strictly in terms of work, I do feel like that has actually changed over the last, I don't know, 10 years or something. It's less common for people to constantly brag about that. And maybe that's just me and, you know, it's so minor, like the needle has moved so little that it's not something you would even notice for 10 or 20 more years. But that kind of change tends to arise from that, from people realizing that this sort of thing isn't okay.
Yeah, so the other part of this equation is productivity and whether long hours actually does lead to more productivity. Yeah. And there have been a lot of studies and scientific facts that people point out, research that people point out that points to your brain kind of just slowing down and not really being as productive, making more mistakes after you're working a certain number of hours at a time, like six or seven hours after that, you're just like totally decreasing. But the flip side of that, and I think anyone who works anywhere can vouch for this, is that you can really do a lot more in bursts. And you can, I mean, for example, just to talk about my own life, like, I would not have written a book while also working at Kotaku if I was not working on that book on nights and weekends. And I loved it and was happy to put in all that extra time, but it was, that was crunching. I mean, that's part of being a workaholic.
Yeah. Do you think, to draw a distinction, do you think that it made a difference that the book was a different project than Kotaku? And so you could kind of, you know, partition those in your mind, and now it's time to work on the book, and it's a pretty different kind of writing. Did that help at all, that it was different?
Yes, big part of that. And also a big part of it is that because of the nature of our work, a lot of our work isn't necessarily like actively doing things. I'm not just like Photoshopping things all day. I'm not just doing things all day without breaks. I spend a lot of time reading Twitter and looking at feeds and just checking the world, reading the internet. I spend a lot of time during the day just reading the internet because that's just part of the job, reading all the game sites, reading the forums. So I don't have, I've never, my work style has never been just intense, 8 hours of intense work. And maybe things would be different if it was like that. And maybe just having constant breaks throughout the day is what makes me able to work a lot of extra hours without getting totally fried.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of like, this is totally complicated and nuanced. And like anyone who tells you like crunch is bad, there's no easy way, there's no...
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
It's very simple, like never work more than 8 hours. Like that's not reality. And I think it's really important to think about all of these things and talk about all
of them. Yeah, I think, you know, just to keep harping on the same idea, I think it's important to look at reality, to know what reality is, which reporting like yours is very helpful with, and then to ask the question, how can we make this better? Instead of getting into these philosophical questions of, is this possible? Can we eliminate this entirely? Can we make this perfect, better world? Instead of being Dutch Vanderland, just sort of looking around the world and trying to make it a little bit better and to learn what we're doing and improve it, which is, you know, that's a good goal and an achievable one. It is something that people can do.
So that leads to a really interesting question, but I'm going to tease people and say we're going to take another break and then we will talk about that question and also your music pick of the week. So let's take a break. And we are back. I know you have been hanging on, wondering what this question would be. It's possible that there was
no ad. It's possible it was just a guitar
there was no
and
ad,
it.
And you've just been waiting 5 seconds. Yeah, in which case, great. The question is, should fans be boycotting Red Dead Redemption 2 and other games that require a great deal of crunch to make? So that also means Uncharted 4. That also means The Witcher 3. That also means God of War, which had really bad crunch, according to people worked on that game. That's a question a lot of people have been asking. I have a lot of thoughts on that. I want to open it to you first and hear your thoughts on whether you think fans should be boycotting, whether you think that's a good move, whether you think that's a useful move in helping make things better.
No. So that's my answer, basically. And okay. We did discuss this some last week, but no. I think, especially in this case, it's just not... I just don't think that that's helpful. So many people are so proud of this thing that they made. And the thing that they made is such a wonderful, in some ways, just embodiment of the incredible labor that they poured into it. I know that it was hard for people to make it. And I, you know, but that didn't matter. That mattered less than just how wonderful the thing they made was. And I would imagine that most of them are glad to hear that, you know, would be happy. So I don't see that being helpful. I think the important thing is to keep talking about this stuff and to push for legislation and elect politicians who are in favor of unions and in favor of workers' rights and, you know, in favor of removing so much power from corporations and people with all the money. Like, I think that all really matters. That's the kind of cultural shift that's going to have to happen in order for this current ecosystem that we're in to just get better. Like I was saying, it's boycotting a video game is at the very, very low down on the list of things that can effectively bring about
change.
It'd
be like boycotting your iPhone. Yeah, you're right that we talked about this last week, but I want to bring up a point that I don't think I brought up last week, unless my brain is just totally gone.
It's possible.
I don't remember. So I think that one of the things we've talked about, and one of the only things that workers can really do to stand up for themselves, is unionization. And I actually think it would help a lot if game developers were able to speak out and know that fans would stand behind them in terms of unionization. Like if fans were to make Reddit threads and be like, we support you guys. If fans use Twitter hashtags or like put out social media campaigns or whatever else to support an organization effort, I think that would be helpful in so many ways. I think that if the bosses, if management at these studios knew that a lot of people were just standing up and making noise about this, it would really make things easier for the people who want to unionize. And even the people who are anti-unionization for whatever reason, I think just supporting developers of being able to just vote on it and choose for themselves whether they want to do this, which I think is the first step in any union shop, is to make a vote. And a majority of employees has to want it to happen in order for it to happen. Mm-hmm. So that's what would happen. And I think just being able to push for that, I think that's really the only thing that can help solve some of these problems that we talked about, or if not solve them, at least alleviate some of these problems.
I think that's really, really true, and a really cool sentiment. Just that if players are listening to this, if anybody who likes video games listening to this is wondering, what can I do about this? That's the answer. I mean, we've seen gamers do huge campaigns about whatever, Battlefront 2 and microtransactions and anything else that they're, you know, rightly upset about. This seems like an opportunity for organization that would actually move the needle. So that's super true.
Yeah. So what if someone who's listening to this right now decides, hey, I'm going to start a thread on Reddit. I'm going to start a thread on Reset Era, and I'm going to say, hey, we're going to start this campaign. Unionize now. # whatever.
Yeah.
And just starts a conversation at the very least, or some sort of campaign where it's like pushing. I remember how effective it was when people fought back against Microsoft's DRM and were just like, # no DRM, # like whatever. Just they forced Microsoft to change. Same with Battlefront 2's microtransactions. Like people just like you just said, like people, that's the power that fans have. Imagine if they took that voice, that power, and used it for something good in terms of advocating for game developers.
Right.
I just, like, man, I know unionization is not going to solve every single problem. It's not going to be the cure-all for every disease that ails you, Mr. Marston, that ails the video game industry. But yeah, it's just a step. It's just something that I think can help a lot. Just letting people have a voice, man. I get worked up about this stuff, just hearing stories and just knowing how painful the process of making games can be. And it just shouldn't be. Like, it should be hard to make video games. It's never not going to be hard, but it shouldn't cost you your marriage. It shouldn't cost you your mental health. Like, I just heard so many stories over the years that just, it doesn't have to be this way, mm-hmm. man.
I agree. Anyway, agree with all of that. Here. So, you know, that's
on that that's note. What I got to on that say. Note, let's talk about your music pick of the week.
All right, nice. Do you want to do some off-topic picks first, or just go straight to
the
music?
Just real quick, let's get through some stuff. Yeah. I finished BoJack Horseman season 5, which is interesting and depressing and cool, emotional.
Yeah,
I think I have to watch it again to really let it sink in.
Yeah,
it does some interesting stuff. The second to last episode is another one of those that just plays with format and does crazy things.
Yeah, I'll watch it when I'm emotionally ready. I think Red Dead Redemption was pretty draining, but
maybe we can do a segment about it in the future.
That'd be cool. Or just a segment about that show in general would be cool.
Yeah, such a good show. I want to rewatch the whole thing, so maybe we can both rewatch the whole thing and just do a BoJack segment, spoiler casting.
That'd be fun. Any excuse to rewatch BoJack. The show is a very good rewatchable show because it's so dense.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I have a little off-topic recommendation. It's just something I've been listening to that's a podcast on the Ezra Klein Show, where he's talking with Jay Rosen, who's an NYU journalism professor and sort of a journalism, just an expert in journalism who's been following it and talking about it for a long time. And they have this really sort of complicated discussion about political journalism and the role of journalism and the failings of journalism. And if you're a journalism junkie at all, or a journalist like we are, it is a really fascinating listen. I think it's just a very challenging and just a conversation that raises a lot of questions and tries to come up with answers and is very real and very by two very, very knowledgeable people who are total journalism junkies and just have been doing this for a long time. So that's on the Ezra Klein Show. It's like on the Vox podcast network. It's very good. Enjoy
it. Cool. Very cool. I find that when I'm listening to podcasts, I just can't do politics podcasts. It's just too depressing. Like I want to escape when I'm listening to podcasts. Yeah. So my podcasts of choice are sports podcasts and D&D podcasts. Not another D&D podcast is my one of choice. So that's my
I might switch to that. I listen to a lot of political podcasts, though. They go in.
So does my wife, and I tell Amanda, like, it's just going to depress you every morning. It's just rough. It's like,
it's a lot.
Totally. Like I'm all for, like, I think everyone should be an informed citizen reading all the news and whatnot. I don't think anyone should shut their politics out of their lives, especially because some people don't have the privilege of being able to do that. But like, you don't have to make yourself suffer and make your mental health suffer.
It depends on the podcast. I mean, so there, the two that the Slate Political Gab Fest, which is fantastic, and the Voxes of the Weeds podcast are both really good, and I find them both enriching. I listen to, you know, Pod Save America, those guys who are the, you know, liberal, very, very funny and charming ex-Obama staffers who are, you know, like the biggest podcast in the world. They're, mm-hmm. those guys can get exhausting because they're partisan and they're very, you know, they're informative, but I do like listening a little more to just journalists who, you know, while they may have their political leanings, are much more straight about it and just explain the context and the stories. I find those fascinating. So, you know, I'll keep listening to them, though. Yeah, I've actually been dialing back. I mean, partly just this last week. God, it's been crazy because the news has been really actually wild this week, and I haven't been following it at all because I've been in this video game tunnel. And I'll come out for water and just think, oh my God, I can't even right now. So I definitely,
at least that's a reminder that the country, like, whatever, however horrible things are, like, the country, if you just look at it big picture, like, the a lot of things have gotten better in the past 200 years, 100 years.
Yeah, it's not 1899 anymore.
It sure isn't. So there is
that. Well, I guess I'll do my music pick. So my music pick for this week, my music pick for this week is an 80s tune that a lot of people probably know, and then I'm going to ask them to re-listen to this week. It is the Peter Gabriel song Sledgehammer. Here is a clip from it. You could have a big dipper going up and down all around the bends. You could have So this tune is something, I don't know, I've heard a lot of covers of this tune, there's a bunch of different versions of it, it's really famous, everyone knows it. It's been sort of fun to go through, I've just been kind of learning it, like learning it on piano, learning to sing it, and learning the lyrics. First off, the lyrics are hilarious because the whole thing is just like sex metaphors. It's just nothing but like, I'll drive my train to your tunnel and I'll be your sledgehammer, like, oh yeah, baby, which is just kind of funny. And also, the thing I love about this tune is it has that kind of 80s experimental thing where the albums weren't super overproduced in the 80s. It was still pretty basic, you know, bass, drums, guitar. There's a killer horn section on this tune, and the horns just sound killer. Backup vocals just sound killer. Everything is just kind of right there. There's not a lot of synthesizers and electronic stuff and sampled things. Like, music just wasn't really doing that. So there's a kind of cleanness to it. And the drummer is a guy named Manu Katché, and the bassist is Tony Levin, who are two names that anyone really following music knows just because those guys play on like a billion records in the 80s and 90s. They were two of the top studio dudes. And just listen to the groove, the bass drum groove on this tune for a second. It's just the nastiness of the band. This is a nasty one, Jason.
So nasty.
We haven't had a nasty track in a while, but the nastiness of Tony Levin's bass playing on this track just kills me. I never really noticed it before, but just how rocking and like soulful the band is. It sounds like a Stax record track almost or something. It has this kind of really classic sound to it. So that's a great tune. That's from So. It's a record that came out in 1986. It's a really cool record. Peter Gabriel is like an amazing friggin' musician that I've been listening to more and just want to listen to more, and everyone should check him out. So that is my music pick for this week.
Kirk, so partially inspired by your music picks, I just dug my guitar out of the closet the other day and have been tooling around with it. It's still, the strings are all there.
That's
so
good.
I was able to tune it and get it playing, but it does not keep a tune. I have to go get it restrung because I haven't really been playing it in years. So I'm going to go. The problem is there's only one guitar store in New York City, and it's all the way down near our office. So one day I'm just going to bring it to work.
Nice. Do it. I always tell people that's like a big, an ongoing campaign of mine, is that everyone who knows an instrument or learned an instrument, just take that instrument out of the closet, whatever it is, even if it's like the French horn or something, and just play it a little bit. Like, just remind yourself that you can play a musical instrument and do that, because it's a very cool thing to
do. It's interesting. First of all, some things just come back to you right away, at least the like the basic stuff, and like you have a feel for it. I think if you've been playing guitar a lot, even if you just don't pick it up, like just picking it up, you get a feel. It's sort of like riding a bike. Maybe we can, the next time we have like a live show, we can play.
We totally
play
should. Yeah, musicians call that getting it under your fingers. I played a show last weekend, a jazz show, that, and I hadn't played jazz in a while on saxophone. And I was talking to Emily about this actually, about the weirdness of when something's under your fingers, how your brain just automatically, I'll just play like complicated licks that I just barely remembered. Or I'll sit down and try to play a song that I wrote 6 years ago that I hadn't thought about in 6 years, and be like, oh wait, that's right, and just your body remembers it. I think that's a very fascinating thing, but that's super cool, and yes, we should absolutely play some music together next time we get a chance.
Excellent. Maybe our weekly music pick can be just us playing
this week's weekly music pick is these two podcasters.
Yeah, us playing the split screen theme song.
Nice.
All right, so Kirk, I am very excited to just spend this entire weekend marathoning Red Dead Redemption
and
2.
And I am very excited to hear what you think of it and to talk to you about it.
Yeah, don't worry. I will be texting you the whole time.
Excellent.
And we will definitely talk more about it next week once I've gotten my hands on it. Also going to finish Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which I will hopefully do soon. So lots of things to play. And yeah, I hope that everyone has a good weekend and enjoys the rest of their October,
same,
their Halloween. And we will see you all next week.
Yeah, see you next week, Jason. Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. And we hope that you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.